You are listening to RudolfSteinerAudio.com. This is a reading of a cycle of lectures by Rudolf Steiner entitled The Light Course, which was given around the time of the founding of the first Waldorf School, actually a few months later, I believe. This is Lecture 3, given in Stuttgart on December 25th, 1919. I have been told that the culmination of our study yesterday, the phenomenon that appears by means of the prism, was difficult for many to understand. But please, don't let that worry you. Understanding will come bit by bit. We will deal especially with light and color phenomena in more depth, so that this veritable piece de resistance, for that is what they are, even for the rest of physics, can provide us with a good foundation. You understand that first I have to tell you especially about some of those things that you cannot find in books and aren't the object of normal scientific studies, things that to a certain extent we can only deal with here. Then in the last lectures we can delve into how what we have studied here can also be used in lessons. What I tried to explain to you yesterday is indeed essentially a special form of the interaction of brightness and turbidity. I wanted to demonstrate that color phenomena behaving as polar opposites to each other arise by means of the different kinds of interaction between brightness and turbidity, appearing especially during the passage of a beam of light through a prism. First, I will ask you to swallow the bitter pill that the difficulty in understanding this matter comes from the fact that you, I am speaking of those who have difficulty in understanding, would actually like to have the light and color theory formulated kinematically. By virtue of our peculiar education, people have become accustomed to believe only those concepts that are more or less kinematic with reference to outer nature. That is, those concepts that deal only in terms of number, formal space, and movement. Now you are supposed to make the effort to think in terms of qualities, and really, in a certain sense, you can say, quote, here I already falter, close quote. But you can ascribe that completely to the unnatural course scientific development has taken in more recent times, which you will even go through in a certain way with your students. Parenthesis, I mean the teachers of the Waldorf School and other teachers. Close parenthesis. For naturally, it will not be immediately possible to inject healthy ideas into the school of today. Instead, we will have to build bridges. Now, let's take a look at light and color phenomena from another point of view. I would like to begin today with a much contested remark of Goethe's. In Goethe, you can read how, in the 1780s, he became known for all sorts of assertions about the appearance of color in and under light. In other words, about the phenomena that we started to talk about yesterday. He had been told that the general view of physicists was that if colorless light passed through a prism, it would be split, taken apart. The phenomena were interpreted more or less thus. If we catch a colorless beam of light, at first it reveals a colorless image to us. If we put a prism in the path of this beam of light, we get the series of colors, red, orange, yellow, green, blue, light blue, dark blue, violet. This came to Goethe's attention. Indeed, he discovered that physicists explain the matter by saying that the colorless light actually already contains these seven colors. How is, of course, difficult to imagine, but this is what was said. When we pass the light through the prism, it does nothing but separate out, like a fan, what the light already contains. It breaks this down into the seven colors. Goethe wanted to get to the bottom of this matter and borrowed all sorts of instruments, just as we have tried to collect them in the past few days, in order to determine how things were. He had Wittner, the court counselor in Jena, send him these instruments. Then he stored them away, intending to do his research at an opportune time. Counselor Wittner became impatient and demanded the instruments back from Goethe, and demanded the instruments back before Goethe had done anything with them, with some things, it just happens that we don't get to them right away. Goethe had to pack up the instruments, so he quickly took the prism, thinking that if light is broken up by a prism, he would take a look at it on the wall. He expected that the light would appear neatly divided into 7 colors. But color appeared only where there was some kind of edge, where there was a muddy spot on the wall, so that the muddiness, the darkness, collided with the brightness. There he could see colors if he looked through the prism, but where there was an even white, he saw nothing. Then Goethe became suspicious and lost his faith in the whole theory. Now, he had no desire to send back the instruments. He kept them and pursued the matter further, and it turned out that the matter is not at all the way it is ordinarily portrayed. If we let light pass through the space of the room, we get a white circle on a screen. Now, if we put a prism in the path of this body of light that is passing through, the beam of light is diverted. Initially, however, the 7 colors in a row don't appear at all. Rather, on the lower edge, only a reddish color appears that merges into yellowish, and on the upper edge, a bluish color that merges into greenish. In the middle, it remains white. What did Goethe say to himself then? He said, "It really isn't a case of light being split up. Instead, I am actually reproducing an image. This image is only the reproduction of the section here. The section has edges, and the colors don't appear because they are extracted from the light, because the light was split into them, but because I am projecting the image, and the image itself has edges. Thus, here I am dealing with the fact that at the point where light and dark meet, for outside this circle of light there is darkness in the surrounding area, and within it is the light, there at the edges the colors appear. The colors initially appear purely as marginal phenomena, and by showing the colors as marginal phenomena, we basically have the archetypal phenomenon before us. We don't have the archetypal phenomenon before us at all if we make the circle smaller and get a continuous color image. While in the case of the big circle, the marginal colors remain marginal colors, the continuous color image emerges only because, in the case of the small circle, the colors continue from the edge inward to the middle. They overlap in the middle and create what we call a continuous spectrum. Thus, the archetypal phenomenon is the one in which colors appear on the edges, where light and dark merge. You see, it is a matter of not using theories to interfere with the facts, but of staying purely with the study of the bare facts. We are not only concerned with what we see in terms of the appearance of colors. As you have seen, a displacement of the entire beam of light takes place, a sideways diversion of the entire beam of light. If you want to pursue this sideways diversion schematically, you can do so roughly as follows. Assume that you fit 2 prisms together, so that the lower one, which together with the upper one forms a whole, is placed like the one I sketched for you yesterday, and there's a figure. The upper prism is placed opposite the lower one. If I allowed a beam of light to pass through this double prism, I would naturally have to get something similar to what I got yesterday. I would get 2 diversions, one downward and the other upward. If I had such a double prism here, I would get a light image that was more extended lengthwise. But at the same time, this more extended light image would turn out to be very indistinct and dark. This is understandable when, by capturing this image on a screen, I get a reproduction of the circle of light that is pushed into itself. But I would also move the screen in. Once again, I would get a reproduction. In other words, there would be a distance, all of this remains within the facts, within which I would always find it possible to get a reproduction. You can conclude that we are manipulating the light by means of the double prism. Outside, I will always find a red edge. In fact, at both the top and the bottom, and violet in the middle. While otherwise I got only an image from red to violet, now I get red on the outer edges and violet in the middle, with the other colors in between. Thus, with such a double prism, I could make it possible for such a figure to emerge. However, I would also get this figure if I moved the screen. Therefore, I have a certain distance within which it is possible for an image to appear that has color on the edges, but also has color in the middle, and all sorts of transitional colors. Now, if I walk up and down with the screen, we can prevent the possibility of such images being created in quite a wide space. However, you probably suspect that this possibility could only be created if I changed the prism constantly, because a prism whose angle is greater here would project the image at a different place than if I made the angle smaller and got a shorter distance here. I can make the whole situation different if I don't have a prism with straight surfaces, but instead work with curved surfaces from the very beginning. Thereby, we can simplify considerably something that is otherwise extraordinarily difficult to study with a prism, and we get the following possibility. First, we allow the beam of light to pass through the space, and then we place the lens, which is actually nothing but a double prism with curved surfaces, in the path. Now the image I get is considerably reduced in size. What has actually happened here? The entire beam of light is contracted, narrowed. Here we have a new interaction between matter, the matter in the lens, in the glass body, and the light that is passing through space. The lens acts on the light so that it contracts the beam of light. We will sketch the whole thing out schematically. Here I have a beam of light in a side view, and let the light pass through the lens. If I were to set up an ordinary glass or water plate against it, the beam of light would simply pass through it, and a reproduction of the beam of light would result on the screen. That isn't the case if instead of a glass or water plate I have a lens. If I simply trace what has happened with a line, then I have to say that a reduction of the image has resulted. Thus the beam of light is contracted. There is yet another possibility, which is that we don't copy the arrangement of a double prism, like the one I have drawn here, but instead of a double prism, whose cross-section is formed such that the prisms meet at this edge. And there's another figure. Of course, then I would get the same description I made before, but with a considerably enlarged circle. Once again, by walking up and down with the screen, I would have the possibility of getting a more or less distinct image within a certain distance. In this case, I would have a violet and bluish color above and also below, and in the middle I would have red. Before it was reversed, and in between are the intermediate colors. Once again, I can replace this double prism with a lens having this cross-section. This lens, and there's, he's speaking of figure 3a, is thick in the cross-section across the middle and thin at the edges. And this lens, figure 3b, is thin in the middle and thick at the edges. In this case, I get an enlarged image, which is significantly larger than the normal cross-section that would emerge from the beam of light. I get an enlarged image, but also with the gradation of colors on the edges and toward the middle. Thus, if I want to investigate these phenomena, I have to say that the beam of light has been expanded. It has essentially been driven apart. That is a simple fact. What can we conclude from these phenomena? we see that there is a relationship between the substance we first encounter in the lenses as transparent matter and what makes its appearance because of the light. We also see a certain kind of interaction, for given what we arrive at by using a lens that is thick at the edges and thin in the middle, what do we have to say when we have such a lens before us? That the whole beam of light has been driven apart, it has been expanded. And we also see how this expansion is possible. It takes place because the substance through which the light has passed is thin here and thicker here. There the light has to penetrate through more material than here in the middle, where it penetrates through less material. What happens then with the light? Well, we said that it is expanded, driven apart. It is driven apart in the direction of these two arrows. What can have driven it apart, though? Well, simply the circumstance that it had to pass through less matter in the middle and more at the edges. Consider the situation. In the middle, the light has less substance to pass through and thus goes through more easily. Therefore, when it has passed through, it still has more force. Here, where it goes through less material, it has more energy than where it goes through more material. The stronger force in the middle, which is caused by the light's going through less material, pushes the beam of light apart. This is something that you can infer directly from the facts. Please be clear that this is a matter of the right use of the method, of logical thinking. If we draw lines to follow what appears in the light, we have to be clear that we are actually only adding something with the drawing that has nothing to do with the light. If I draw the lines here, then I am merely drawing the limits of the beam of light. This opening creates this beam of light. Thus what I am drawing has nothing to do with the light. Instead, the beam is caused by the fact that the light passes through this slit. And if I say in this instance that the light moves in this direction, again, that has nothing to do with the light. For if I were to push the source of light up, then the light would move this way when it fell through the slit, and I would have to draw the direction of the arrows thus. All of this would have nothing to do with the light itself. We are accustomed to drawing lines into the light so that we have gradually come to speak of rays of light. We aren't dealing anywhere with rays of light. We are dealing with a cone of light that is caused by a slit through which we let the light pass. We are dealing with a broadening of the cone of light. And we have to say that somehow the broadening of the cone of light must be connected to the shorter path that the light travels here, in the middle, then here at the edge. Because of the shorter path here in the middle, the light retains more force. Because of the longer path at the edge, more of its force is taken away. The stronger light in the middle presses the weaker light at the edge, and the cone of light is broadened. That is what you can conclude. Now you can see that although we are actually dealing only with metaphors, in physics people talk about everything possible, about rays of light and such things. These rays of light have actually become the subsoil for materialistic thinking in this area. In order to make what I have just explained more concrete, we shall look at something else. Assume that we have a tub here, a small container. In this small container we have a liquid, for example water, and an object, let's say a coin or the like, is lying on the bottom. If I have an eye here, EYE, I can do the following experiment. First, I can leave out the water and look at the object with the eye, figure 3C. I will see the object in this direction. What are the facts of the matter? I have an object lying on the bottom of a container. I look, and I see this object in a certain direction. Those are the simple facts of the case. Now I begin to draw. A ray of light starts out from this object, is sent into the eye, and affects the eye, and then I fantasize all sorts of possible things about it. Now, I fill the container up to here with water or any other liquid, figure 3D. And something quite special happens. I trace the same direction from the eye to the object in which I saw the object before and look in that direction. I could expect to see the same thing, but I don't. Instead, something highly peculiar occurs. I see the object a bit raised. I see it in such a way that it is raised along with the entire bottom of the container. Of course, you can talk about how we can determine that. I mean, measure it later. Right now, I just want to talk about the principles. What could be the basis of this if I am going to answer the question about the facts of the matter? Now, I expect to find the object in the same direction in which I looked earlier. I direct my eye toward it, but I don't see it in that direction. I see it in another direction. Of course, before, when there was no water in the container and only air between my eye and the bottom, I was able to look down directly to the bottom. Now my line of sight collides with the water here, which doesn't let my eyesight through so easily as the air. It offers greater resistance, and I have to shy away from the greater resistance. From this point on, I have to shy away from the greater resistance. This shying away is expressed in the fact that I don't see to the bottom, but that instead the whole thing appears to be raised. I see with more difficulty, so to speak, through the water than through the air. It is harder for me to overcome the resistance of the water than that of the air. So I have to shorten the force, thus pulling the object itself upward. I shorten the force in meeting a stronger resistance. If I were able to fill this with a gas that was thinner than air, the object would sink, because then I would meet less resistance. Thus I would push the object downward. Figure 3E. Physicists don't state the facts of the matter in this way. Instead, they say that a ray of light is thrown onto the surface of the water. The ray of light is bent there, because a transition takes place between a thicker medium and a thinner one. The angle of incidence of the ray of light is bent, and the light arrives at the eye here. And then they say something very curious. After the eye has received the information by means of the ray of light, it lengthens the path outward and projects the object onto this spot here. In other words, physicists discover all sorts of concepts, but they don't reckon with what is there, with the resistance that the power of vision itself meets in the thicker substance it has to penetrate. To a certain extent, they would like to leave out everything else and attribute everything to the light, just as in the case of the prism, where they say, quote, "Oh, the prism doesn't do anything at all. The seven colors are already contained in the light. The prism only provides the occasion for them to line up so nicely next to each other like soldiers, the seven colors. But these seven naughty boys who are forced to step out separately are already in there, together. The prism doesn't do any of it." Close quote. As we saw, it was exactly what took place in the prism, in this darkened wedge, that caused the colors. The colors themselves have nothing to do with the light itself. Here, once again, we have to be clear that we are actively carrying out work, aiming with our eye and meeting stronger resistance in the water. And because of this, we are forced to shorten the line of sight through the stronger resistance. The physicists, however, say that the rays of light are cast, bent, and so forth. And then, here is the best part of all. Today's physicists say that first the light arrives at the eye in a bent path, and then the eye projects the image outward. What does that mean? In the end, the physicists say, the eye projects. They posit a kinematic conception, a conception bereft of all reality, a pure fantasy activity, in place of what immediately presents itself. The resistance of the thicker water to the eye's power of sight. It's at just such points that you notice most clearly how abstracted everything is in our physics, how everything is supposed to become kinematics, how they don't want to get go into qualities. On the one hand, they divest the I of any kind of activity. On the other hand, the I projects outward the stimulus it receives. What is necessary, however, is that we begin at the outset with the activity of the I, that we be clear that the I is an active organism. Now, you see, we have a model of the I, and today we will also begin to deal with the nature of the human I. The I is, of course, a ball of sorts, just compressed a bit from front to back, a ball that sits here in the bone socket in such a way that first a series of skins surround the inner part of the eye. If I want to draw the cross section, I would have to do it like this, figure 3F. What I'm drawing now would be the right eye. If we were to take the eye out of the skull and dissect it, the outermost part, which we would find first, would be connective tissue, fat. But then we come to the first actual covering of the eye, the so-called sclera and cornea. This outermost covering is sinewy, bony, and cartilaginous. I've drawn it in here. It becomes transparent toward the front, so that the light can penetrate from here into the eye. A second layer, lining the interior space, is the so-called choroid, which contains the blood vessels. That would be approximately here. Third, we have the innermost layer, the so-called retina, whose continuation into the skull is the optic nerve. Thus, the optic nerve would go inside here and form the retina. And here we've listed the three coverings of the eye. Now, however, behind the cornea, embedded here in the ciliary muscle, is a kind of lens. It is carried by a muscle, here called the ciliary muscle. Toward the front, here is the transparent cornea, and between it and the lens is what is called the aqueous humor. When light enters the eye, it first passes through the transparent cornea, then through the aqueous humor, then through this lens, which can be moved independently by muscles. Then the light passes beyond this lens into what we usually call the vitreous body, which occupies the entire space within the eye. Thus the light passes through the transparent cornea, the aqueous humor, the lens itself, the vitreous body, and from there to the retina, a branching of the optic nerve which leads then into the brain. These things show us schematically the principal elements in the eye. However, this eye reveals extraordinary peculiarities. First, if we study the aqueous humor, this liquid between the lens and the cornea, through which light has to pass, we find that in terms of its contents, it is almost a real liquid, almost an external liquid. At this point of the aqueous humor, between the lens and the outer cornea, the human being is physically like a piece of the outer world to a certain extent. It is almost the case that this liquid, in the outermost periphery of the eye, hardly distinguishes itself from a liquid I would pour onto my hand here. And the lens is also something very, very objective, very, very inorganic. However, if I go on to the vitreous body, which occupies the interior of the eye and borders on the retina, I cannot regard it in this way at all. I cannot say that this is also something almost like an external liquid or an external body. There is vitality in it already. There is life in it. Thus, the farther we go back into the eye, the more we press forward into life. Here, in the front, we have a liquid that is objectively almost entirely external. Even the lens is external. But in the case of the vitreous body, we are already standing within a structure that has inherent vitality. This difference between what is outside and that which is inside shows itself in something else as well. Even this could be studied in the natural sciences today. If we look at the formation of the eye comparatively, starting with the lower order of animals, we find that what comprises the external aqueous body and the lens does not grow from inside out. Instead, it is formed by the accretion of the surrounding cells. Thus, I would have to think of the lens forming in such a way that the lens tissue and even the frontal aqueous humor emerge from the neighboring organs and not from the inside out, while the vitreous body grows from the inside toward them. Here we have something curious. The nature of external light is at work and brings about the transformation that produces the aqueous humor and the lens. The animal reacts to this from within and pushes something more alive, something more vital, out toward it, the vitreous body. It is particularly in the eye that the formations stimulated from the outside in and those stimulated from the inside out meet each other in quite a curious way. That is the first peculiarity of the eye. There is yet another peculiarity which lies in the fact that the spreading retina is actually the spreading optic nerve. The peculiarity consists in the fact, tomorrow I will try to show you an experiment to confirm this, that the eye is insensitive where the optic nerve enters. It is blind there. The optic nerve spreads out. At a place located somewhere to the right of the point of entry, in this case of the right eye, the retina is the most sensitive. Now, you can say it is the nerve that senses the light. However, it doesn't sense the light precisely at its point of entry. You would think that if it were really the nerve that senses the light, it would have to sense it most strongly at the place where it enters. However, it does not. For the time being, I would like you to keep that in mind. Now, from the following example, you can conclude that the setup of the eye is full of the extraordinary wisdom of nature. As long as your eyes are more or less healthy, you find that when you examine the objects around you during the day, they appear more or less sharp to you. In any case, their sharpness or clarity is sufficient for orientation. But sometimes when you wake up in the morning, you see the edges of objects very unclearly, as if they were surrounded by a little fog. If the object is a circle, you see something unclear around it. What is the cause of this? It is caused by the fact that we have three different things in our eye. We will take just two into consideration, the vitreous body and the lens. As we have seen, they have completely different origins. The lens is formed more from outside, the vitreous body more from within. The lens is less alive. The vitreous body is permeated with vitality. The moment we awake, the two of them are not yet adjusted to each other. The vitreous body tries to reproduce the objects the way it can, and the lens does it the way it can, and we have to wait until they have mutually focused themselves. You can see from this how mobile the organic is, and how the effects of the organic are based on the fact that the activity in the lens and that in the vitreous body are differentiated at first, and are then put together again out of the differentiated elements. They both have to adjust to each other. On the basis of all these things, we will try little by little to arrive at how the world of color results from the interrelationship between the eye and the outer world. To this end, we want to take a look at the following experiment now, so that tomorrow we can connect it to observations about this relationship of the eye to the outer world. As you can see, here I have a disc painted with the colors that have come to our attention as the colors of the rainbow: violet, indigo, blue, green, yellow, orange, and red. If you look at the wheel here, you see these seven colors. I have done it as well as it is possible to do with these colors. Now, first we'll turn the disc. You still see the seven colors just in movement. Now I will make the disc rotate very rapidly. When the thing rotates fast enough, you don't see the colors anymore. Instead, you see, I believe, a monochromatic gray. Isn't that right? Or did you see something else? Audience replies, purple, reddish. Yes, that's because the red is somewhat too strong in relation to the other colors. I did try to compensate for that by giving it less space. But if the arrangement were completely right, you would actually see a monochromatic gray. Then we have to wonder why these seven colors appear to us as monochromatic gray. We'll try to answer this question tomorrow. Today we'll just put forth what physics says. It says, just as it said in Goethe's time, that I have the colors red, orange, yellow, green, blue, indigo, and violet. Now I rotate the disc. Because of this, the impression of the light does not have an effect on the eye. Instead, if I have just seen red here, because of the rapid rotation of the disc, orange is already there. And if I have seen orange, yellow is already there, and so forth. And while I still have the other colors, red is already there again. Because of this, I have all the colors at the same time. The impression of red is not yet finished when violet arrives. Thereby, the colors are put together for the eye, and there has to be white once again. There was also the teaching in Goethe's time. This was also the teaching in Goethe's time. Goethe was taught that if we make a color disc and rotate it quickly, the seven colors, which are so well behaved when they separate from each other out of a beam of light, will unite once again in the eye itself. However, Goethe never saw white. Rather, he said that all you ever got was gray. Of course, more recent physics books also find that you only get gray. However, in order to make the story turn out white after all, they advise that a black contrast circle should be made in the middle. Then the gray will appear white in contrast. This, as you can see, is a nice way of doing it. Some people do it with fortune. The physicists do it with nature. Thus do we correct nature. It actually happens that nature is corrected in a number of the most fundamental facts. You see, I'm trying to proceed in such a way that a foundation is laid. Only when we have laid a good foundation will we be able to make progress in all areas. The end of Lecture 3.